Thank you for listening to the Data Is My Science podcast, the show that makes data your passion, with your host, Dapper Data.
What's up, everybody? You are listening to the Data Is My Science podcast, the show that makes data your passion. I am your host, Dapper Data. As you know, I dive deep into all kinds of data science work, data management, technology, programming. I even talk to people who are not data science related, right? I talk to a lot of different career-focused people, so finance industry, right, which is somebody that we're going to talk to today. I talk about restaurants. I talk about pharmacy. You name it. Everybody uses data to make those data-driven decisions. That's what we call it, okay? And today I brought a special guest on, and I'll definitely introduce him in a little bit. But today we'll discuss the data used behind financial growth experts and decision makers, all right? We're going to talk about what bad data means and how it's used in the financial industry. We'll also talk a little bit about how to find that bad data, because that's important. And we'll go over some tools, some AI tools that are used out there that the experts love to use in the financial industry as well. So without further ado, I want to introduce you to Mark Willis. Say hi, Mark.
Hey there. Hey, Bobby. Hey, everybody.
So Mark is a certified financial planner, a three-time number one best-selling author, and the owner of Lake Grove Financial Services, a financial firm out in Chicago, Illinois. And Mark Willis, he's known as a person that is a man on a mission to help you think differently about your money, your economy, and your future. So tell them a little bit about yourself, Mark.
Well, thanks. We are on a mission, that's for sure. Just like Chicago Blues Brothers say, we're on a mission from God to take people's their financial insanity and give them some sanity, which is sorely lacking in our world today. And the focus is mainly on helping look at the financial life with truth, clarity, realism, but also counterintuitive and contrarian ways to build real wealth, maybe in ways that are not so average. You know, I'm not your average financial planner, and we do use data and try to pick apart fact from fiction with that information.
Yeah, definitely. And I appreciate you being on. You know, I've definitely done a lot of research on you, Mark. And I've read that you have actually done you do a podcast as well, right? You know, so you co-host a podcast, and on that podcast, and the name of the podcast is Not Your Average Financial Podcast, right? And it's interesting because you talk about real estate, right, and paying for college without going broke, right, which is what I really need. So I'm excited about that. All the kids I have, right?
Mm-hmm. We all do, man. We all do. Right. It's not getting any cheaper, that's for sure.
It's not at all. You know, I'm even thinking about should I just focus on online? I mean, online doesn't get cheaper either, right? It's still a pain, you know. And you might have one of those kids out the bunch to say, look, you know, I just want to do vocational school or something. I don't know, you know, but either way, you want to plan for it. You want to be ahead of the game, you know, so that you're somebody that we need to definitely talk to. And, you know, a lot of people don't understand how data is used in the financial industry to make some of those data driven decisions. So if your company that you have, Mark, the company's called Lake Grove Financial Services, how is data used to make informed decisions?
Boy, that is such a big question. I think when is it not to make big decisions? The trouble is which mm-hmm. data. In fact, just getting ready for this interview today, I just want to read to you some quotes from a book written in 1968. This is one of the best-selling books of all time. It's called The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich. It sold more than 3 million copies. He's a Stanford professor. He was like the academic rock star of his day. He was the only person interviewed one-on-one with Johnny Carson for over an hour without interruption. And he won several prizes, including the equivalent of a Nobel Prize in ecology. So in 1970, he warned on CBS that most of the people in the world are going to die in the great cataclysm in the history of human civilization in the next 15 years. So that would have been 1985. He also said, and I'm quoting this here, populations will inevitably be completely outstripped. Whatever small increases in food supplies we make, the death rate will increase to 100 to 200 million people per year starving to death in the next 10 years. Now, I know that's cold water at the very beginning of a podcast there. That's a stiff drink for sure, Bobby. But I'm not seeing global 100 million people a year dying from starvation, at least not in the United States. We're kind of the opposite problem here in the United States. Uh-huh. So why am I sharing this, you know, kind of bleak picture of the future? Well, again, he wrote the book in 1968, and he predicted with data that we were going to be all starving to death by 1985 due to the population increase. Okay. And he was looking at data and he was looking at information. So the question is really like, one, we got to stay humble when we look at our data. Otherwise we end up making claims like that. And two, which data are we looking at? Because he was looking at a specific filter of information, but he was forgetting about the things that he couldn't see, you know, the incredible increases in efficiency through GMOs, through no-till farming, things that have increased the supply of food that has, you know, revolutionized this world. And we've gone from, I think it was about 2-3 billion people when he was alive to over 7 billion people today. And again, we're living in a world of abundance, not scarcity, not famine, but obesity. So this mass starvation, overpopulated, even in countries like India, you know, we never could have seen things like the Green Revolution take place since he wrote his book. So, you know, what am I saying? I'm saying that we must use data and we must know what numbers to look at. We have to pay attention to the right information and stay humble because we don't know when the next black swan will come through our data set and completely topple over everything.
No, that's a great point.
Question, but that's at least a way to frame the question.
No, that's a great point. And it's interesting because when you look at that, you know, when they're looking at something, when they're making such a statement like that, right, such a profound statement like that, you know, so many years ago, even now, right, when you're making those type of statements, you have to be very careful with those statements because you're trying to predict the future. First of all, you're trying to predict something that can be so chaotic, right? So many variables in the mix, right? You know, you might as well say I'm trying to predict the lottery sometimes that, right? You know, I stay away when I do models, machine learning, all that stuff. I stay away right now from making some hardcore predictions like that because chaotic data, right? You know, I can't predict those things sometimes, right? You know, that's why it's so hard to really, really predict like floods, right? They can say flash flood warning, but you know, if you don't get a flood, you know, that's not on them. They're just warning you ahead of time that it's a possibility, right?
You bet, man. If I shared my screen, could I share a bit about it? Share some of the data? And for those that are just listening, I'll try my very best to describe what we're all looking at here. Let's see if I can do this without breaking the internet here. So I'm going to share my screen, share screen. All right. And here we go. So what do you see on your side there? Are you seeing where are stocks headed?
Yep. I see it.
So let's see if I can do this again. I'm going to try my very best here. So what we're looking at here is the stock market, the Dow Jones specifically from December 1913, through the early and mid 2000s. Mm-hmm. And as you can see, not a lot going on for about 10 years there. And then in 1929, there is the Great Depression and the crash of 1929 and the depression of the 1930s. So what are we seeing first here, Bobby? Well, first, the Great Depression does not look so great as we look at it here, right?
Right.
Doesn't look so great. Looks pretty like a speed bump, but not exactly a worldwide or nationwide depression. Also, when does it break even? We touch 5,000 here, and when does it actually touch 5,000 again? Dow Jones doesn't touch 5,000 again until the mid-1950s. So that's a 25-year waiting period.
Oh, man.
How would that feel? 25 years to get your money back.
Yeah. I wonder what the impact of something like that was on families, on livelihoods, right? You know, suicide rate, whatever it was, right? You know, all those different things. People probably just, I mean, it definitely hit people hard. Right?
Well, and in fact, back in those days, very few people were invested in the stock market. We'll get to that a little later if you want to, but maybe less than 10% of Americans had any kind of assets in equities or bonds. And then, you know, we sort of see some other surges and drawbacks. Again, some major down depression. Here's the 70s, the inflation of the 1970s. This little section right here in the 70s and early 80s, this is when interest rates were rising dramatically and we were seeing mortgage rates in the 17, 20, 21% for a mortgage. Bobby, can you imagine? We're all complaining about 5 and 6% mortgages right now. Can you imagine a 20% mortgage on your house?
Oh my goodness. So,
now, what did that do to the stock market? Well, we can see it clearly, right? It tanks. So what does that portend for our markets today? Well, you know, as you said, and Niels Bohr is a economist. He says prediction is very difficult, especially when it involves the future. And I just love that quote. It keeps me humble. But what do you notice about right there with the circle, the big red circle? Obviously, there's a mega surge in the markets, right? From 1980 to about 2000, there was this unbelievable, unprecedented just surge. And what was going on there, I think, is the baby boomers were coming of age. Okay, so everybody gets their, you know, out of college. The hippies get out of college. They all start going to work and going to school. And the 401k was born in 1981. All right, so what does that mean? That means everybody with a 401k is now automatically invested in the stock market. Mm-hmm. And what does that do when everyone's buying? What does that do to the price?
It goes up, yeah.
And for the next 20 years, that's the case, right? And now we get that wonderful magic, an average of 12% a year in the stock market. So when somebody tells you, hey, you can just get in the stock market and make 12% or 10% or whatever, they were right if they got their financial advisor card in 1980 through 2000. But they were wrong if they look a little further back.
Yeah.
So it's that wonderful, magical period. We call this the Roaring 20. A good colleague of mine calls this the Roaring 20. It was the 20-year period where the markets did an incredible double-digit return as the baby boomers, like a pig in the python, is going through this population slide, right? So I'm going to move on from here, but does any feedback or comment on this chart?
No, this is amazing, you know, and it really tells like a story, right, from beginning to end. And, you know, I mean, I always look at data as, you know, the best way to describe it is telling that story. When you're able to tell a story, it resonates with so many different people, right? You know, if you show this to somebody and you're actually as a CFP and you're helping them understand how the market has gone, you know, and growth and things like that, I think that this would resonate with them a lot better, right? You know?
Yeah. I mean, can they expect a 1980 to 2000? Can they expect that all the time? Well,
but that's what I need, though.
Yeah, that's right. We all hope we want. We hopefully desire, but, you know, we need it. We hope for it, but hope is not a strategy. And what's interesting is after 2001, when the tech bubble burst, you can kind of see it there. And then there's 2008. Let's zoom in on that because from 2000 to 2020, we go from the Roaring 20 to the Boring 20. And this is a 20-year period, effectively, from 2001 to 2013, a 12-year period where there was exactly no growth. That's the start to finish right there from 2001 to 2013.
But that's good for like the conservative people, right?
Say again.
Would it be good for more of the conservative people? And more people who are more focused on just staying steady, right? You know, except for between November 13th through the 14th.
It didn't feel very boring going through it. But, you know, if you were just to look at the value of the market from 2001 till, right before COVID hit, we basically didn't have any gains over that period of time. And in fact, we lost a lot of money due to volatility.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't feel very boring going through the project. I mean, those are some mega surges. If you go back to like the tech wreck of 2001, the real estate crash of 2008. Uh-huh. So it's boring. I call it boring, not because nothing happened, but because we basically lost an entire decade and more from 2001 to 2013. So the next question, yeah, this is that dozen years lost here, if you can kind of see it there. From 2001 to 2013, there's essentially no growth, but there were lots of people losing money.
Yeah, yeah, especially 2009.
That's right, yeah. So it's essentially, for folks just listening, it started at 1300, the S&P 500 started at 1300 and ended at about 1400 over a 13-year period. That's basically no growth for over a decade. Now, the last piece I wanted to share here quickly, this is actually from a third party. This is a group called Dalbar. Dalbar mm-hmm. does a independent research every year to determine over a 30-year period how real investors performed in the stock market. And what they look at is they don't have a dog in the fight. You know, they're not investment advisors. They're not trying to sell you anything. They just do the research. And mm-hmm. the real results of actual investors over 30 years from 2020 back to 1990, basically, what was the real investor returns? And the answer is 2.29%.
Mm.
Not 12%, mm-hmm. not 8%, not even 5% in the stock market, bond market. If you had an index fund and invested from 1990 to 2020, your real return, Bobby, was 2.2%.
Man.
Come on. That's not even worth it for all terrible volatility we've had over 30 years.
It's not worth it at all, man.
Especially when you think about inflation this last year, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, the graph that you showed, right? You know, the one before and with the first like two or three, I think, you know, it gets you to think, right? Say you showed that to somebody that's getting ready to retire and they're like, look, and everything's going down. Do you not retire, right? Or do you wait?
Yeah. Oh, do you wait? No, you're you know? Right.
Imagine having to wait 20 years. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. You got to still buy groceries. You know, it's not like you can do without for 20 years.
Oh, man. So that probably leads to, you know, thinking about where to put your money at during certain times, because when you're high, right, you may want to take a little bit out to put it in something that's going to be a little bit more, I guess, not so aggressive, right, you know, and just sit on the side, because if you are planning to retire soon, then you probably want to make sure that you have something to retire with, and you're not just wasting it all throughout that time.
So true, man. So true. Yeah, you cannot hide from the market in the market.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a great point. You're absolutely right, you know. So on your front page, right, I saw it said, right, what if you could create wealth in a safe and predictable way and become your own source of financing,
mm-hmm.
right? And for me, that really hit home, right? Because when I think about being your source of financing, a lot of times we talk about the vol versus, well, the whole life versus term, right? You know, life yep. insurance, right? So I thought about that, and I thought about being able to become your own or financing your life insurance, if you will, by the time you get a certain age where you don't have to worry about right term, right? You know, I mean, I don't know if you're I don't know if I'm getting in trouble for this, a Dave Ramsey follower, or do you like any of his methods at all or anything like that? You know,
I don't know him personally. I just know of him. He got me hooked on paying off my debt with his snowball method. And
the snowball method too.
I got too hooked on him actually for a while. I thought he had written like the fifth gospel and he knew nothing, he could do no wrong, and he was always right about everything. But turns out he is a human too, and he's not right about everything. In fact, he's dead wrong about some things for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So I agree, right? I wholeheartedly agree, you know, same way. And I look at when you're looking at that wealth building, right? You know, I don't hear too much about that when I listen to Dave Ramsey, right? You know, the real wealth building scenario. And, you know, I've really been, over the past 5 years, I've been trying to focus on something like that. So when you're thinking about wealth building, are we thinking about that long-term game, right? You know, when you're talking about predictable way and then sourcing and financing, are you talking about, you know, when you God forbid, pass away one day and you're able to finance your own funeral, right? Are you talking about all these different aspects or you're just talking about certain parts?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's all one wallet, Bobby. You know, it's all one wallet. You know, how you save for your future retirement impacts your legacy. It impacts how you're going to pay for your kids' college, all of them. Mm-hmm. How you're going to buy your next car, how you're going to rehab the roof. You got to put a new roof on the house next year. It mm-hmm. all impacts everything. And, you know, I'll tell you a quick story. We had a client who was very proud of his, you know, his mutual funds and his 401k. He was getting a very nice, you know, juicy return in his 401k. Let's say it was 9%. I forget exactly what it was. Let's just say it was 9% over the last 3 years. And he felt really happy about that. Meanwhile, he was spending 30-something% on all of his debt. Mm-hmm. Not 30% interest, 30% of his entire income was going to debt. He was a high-earning doctor making $250,000 a year, spending $80,000 a year on interest payments.
Man.
So if you're spending 30% after tax on debt and you got 8 or 9% pre-tax in your 401k, you're not just treading water, man. You're going in the wrong direction.
You're going the opposite way, man. Yeah. You're going backwards.
That's right.
But when you make so much money, right, you might not even think about that.
Yeah, no, you got the kind of Gucci lenses on. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it is.
Luxuries, you know? Well, there's an old phrase, a luxury once enjoyed becomes a necessity. Like here in Chicagoland, we got those heated seats in the wintertime in my car. I'm telling you, man, that thing is a necessity now. it used to be a luxury. Now it's a necessity. Now that we got it.
That's so true. I love the heated seats, you know, especially in the wintertime, right? Yeah. You know, and I can only imagine. I know that you're from Chicago. This is totally off topic. I just know that Chicago is a beautiful place, right? You know, the beach right there. And people don't even realize that there's a beach right there.
Right. Yeah,
Third Coast. And it was amazing, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, you know, so, okay. All right. Being in finance, collecting all of this data that you collect on a regular basis, right? You know, you're collecting client data. You're doing research on your clients, but also research to stay ahead so that you can provide good information to your clients, right? So that they can make better decisions. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about bad data, right? You know, and I talked about that before. And bad data, specifically in the financial industry, I think that is probably something that happens more often than not, right? You know, a lack of both quality data and automated processes that go out there, they continue to shackle transformation efforts at many organizations, right? So we're talking about those huge organizations out there sometimes are making probably bad decisions because they're having bad data, not because their systems are wrong or anything like that, just because they're not cleaning it. They probably have bad data. It's poor quality. So, you know, do you have examples of some of those and give your thoughts on bad data in the financial industry?
Let's see. If you're comfortable with it, I'll just share my screen again because it's a lot more fun to share. So
I love it.
See if I can pull it up here. There we go. Share. All right. I got a couple slides I wanted to share with you here. This is the first one. So this screen, okay, there we go. So what we're looking at here is a tale of two investors.
Mm-hmm.
One has uninterrupted compounding growth. If you had a chunk of money you could put into the stock market, let's say, you know, you had $1,000 that just compounded every single year forever.
Right.
versus the real return of the actual stock market. Both of these numbers that we're looking at here, both of these pathways, the orange line, which is going up and to the right, and incredibly, it reaches $1.3 million, mm-hmm. or the blue line, which says, hey, you don't actually get the $1.3 million. You're going to get closer to $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it surprises me, but both of them are equaling a 6% rate of return on average.
What?
Both of those numbers equal 6% rate of return. Right. Yeah. How is that possible? Right.
Yeah. Right.
Well, the answer is volatility. Investors think they're going to get the orange line. Oh yeah. I've got an average of 6% a year, but the blue line, the smaller line, is the one they actually get. The difference is when you throw losses and volatility and beta into your portfolio. See, these periods of time where you're spent making up lost money is not the same thing as uninterrupted compound growth.
Oh.
All right. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. Let's see if I can go to the next one here. Let's see. Okay. Here's that same chart. Mm-hmm. Again, the difference is volatility. And the way I tell this to folks is, imagine you want to travel from, I don't know, pick it, Los Angeles to New York.
Mm-hmm.
You can fly there in a straight line and get there pretty efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can drive there and you're going up and down and east and west and north and south and stopping for gas and stopping to, you know, at the hotel and spending money at the grocery stores and in the restaurants. Mm-hmm. Which one of those will take a lot more time and energy? And which one is more efficient? Well, obviously, as the crow flies, as they say here in the Midwest, it's more direct to just go straight from one to the other. Without right. stopping in a straight line, right?
Right.
But markets don't do that.
Oh, markets go up and down.
Yep. Yeah. And so yeah. that average return of 7%, in this example, this is a 7% change over here. Let's see if I can show you here. Your real return was only 4%. That's why in that other example where I said the third party does that research, the group is called Dalbar, if folks want to look it up. They do an annual report on investor behavior. While the market might be doing, give a number, right? 8% this year, 10% this year. The mm-hmm. real investors are bouncing around up and down every single day, even if they're not buying and selling, Bobby. Even if they're not buying and selling, just the fact of going up and down and up and down. It's just like, you know, you're getting beat up with volatility. And volatility is the viper in your portfolio that nobody likes to talk about.
Oh, how do you include volatility in there?
Best ways are through, I mean, there's complex formulas like with beta calculations, mm-hmm. standard deviation tests. But the better choice is to say, all right, let's not use an average. Here's a very simple math explainer. Let's say you invested with me $10,000 today. You mm-hmm. gave me $10,000 and I put it to work for you. And let's say that I did an incredible 100% return this year.
Oh, great.
So your 10,000 went up to $20,000, right? You're feeling awesome. You're like, man, this is amazing. And uh-huh. so you keep your money with me for another year and I'm off my game in year two and I lose you half your life savings. So your 20 grand drops back down, cuts in half, back down to 10 grand. Okay. So you uh-huh. started with 10, made it up to 20, came back down to 10.
Uh-huh.
So you went up 100% and you lost 50%. Now, you know, a lot of your math listeners would
say my money. That's like going to the casinos or something. It's like, as long as you leave with your money, right?
Yeah, you feel good. At least you got your money back. Yeah, you're not too happy that I lost you half your life savings.
But, yeah.
But here's the thing. I can advertise and you can tell your buddies at the water cooler. And I can, more importantly and more sinisterly, I suppose, a financial planner, not me because I don't do this stuff. But a financial planner could advertise that he got you a 25% rate of return.
Do math on that,
right? Go up 100%, drop 50%, divide by 2, and that's 25% on average.
Yeah. And that's volatility. Happens, right? That's probably what happens a lot of time.
Well, SEC, you know, Securities and Exchange Commission allows mutual funds, financial planners to advertise average rates of return. Now, what good is an average, right?
Yeah. So, oh, man.
I can't spend an average rate of return at the grocery store.
You can actually make a adjustment so that your average looks better than other average. That bias, right? I mean, that happens all the time, you know, not just the financial industry, but I can only imagine how it happens in the financial industry all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, I mean, that seems like one of the most common problems with financial teams face, the quality and reliability of the data they collect. Right. Yes. Even if you usually have, I guess, access to accurate sources of data, you can still manipulate it. Right.
Oh, yeah. No, and you know, there's trillions of dollars to incentivize financial industries to manipulate that data so that, hey, come on over here where we're paying you, we're paying our investors 7% or 8% or 29%. So it's this, I don't know if this is a family friendly podcast, so I'll be careful with my language. It's a contest of egos. Let's just say that, to try to get everybody to come over here to our really, you know, sexy fund. But I can prove to you with real data that some of the best mutual funds of the last decade got an average return of 18%, but investors actually lost money in that same fund year over year.
Man.
So you can make a bunch of return, but you can actually lose money.
Yeah.
So and I saw this.
Return, right? They highlight the return. If they highlight the return, then it still makes them look good. Right?
Which one can you spend at a grocery store? Money or a rate of return?
Right.
So, I'm a big believer in uninterrupted, true compound growth with as little beta or volatility. That's the fancy word for just volatility as possible. Because if I've got that straight line projection, I've got an increase of my net worth every single year with a predictable, you know, outcome at the end of the story. I don't have to worry about what the market's doing today or this year. I'll still invest and have fun with that money, but it's money I can afford to lose, and it's money I'm not depending on. Because the real gotcha, and it's one thing to be angry at the financial industry for doing that sort of stuff, but it makes a difference when our parents or ourselves are counting on 8% a year in the markets, but we only end up with 3 or whatever. You know, that's the difference between retiring and not retiring, or having steak dinners once a week, you know, or buying cat food for our retirement. I don't want the latter for my family or myself.
Yeah, I definitely do not want that. And I think if I did get that, I probably would deem myself unsuccessful in life.
Well, we beat ourselves up for it, but if we're being told by our financial gurus on the radio or our financial buddy that handles our money for us, if we're being told, oh yeah, you got your 8%, you'll be fine. Here, let me draw you a straight line from where you are today to your retirement at 8%. And we just learned that that straight lines don't happen on the market. We'd have to get 15-18% just to get a compound. The real investment calculator you want to find is something that gives you an internal rate of return or a compound annual growth rate. Those are the real calculations. Average returns mean nothing. Don't listen to a financial pundit talking about average rates of return. It's part of the reason why we call our show Not Your Average Financial Podcast.
All right.
You can't get an average, and nobody is an average, by the way. We're all unique.
No, that's a great point. That's a great point. So as a CFP, and we just talked about that bad data, how do you come across the bad data throughout your process, right? You know, and how do you recognize it? Because I'm going to be honest, even when preparing for this podcast, right, I started looking up, man, how do you recognize bad data as a CFP, right? It's not out there. It's something that is almost like you have to go through the experience and do your own research outside of what they're saying, right? I mean, is that valid? You know, how do you go through that process?
I love listening to contrarians, not because they're always right. They are not always right, but at least they're willing to poke their head up above the crowd. You know, there's a phrase in finance, if you run with the herd, you'll be slaughtered. And that's true when it comes to chasing the latest fad, whether it's a meme stock or, you know, a famous crypto or whatever. we have to be very careful that we don't get slaughtered in the process. So when everyone says, for example, put your money in your 401k, I want to do the math on that.
Yeah.
Let's do the math on that. Is it really true that we'll always save money on taxes if we put it into a 401k? That's the promise. But is it good data or is it bad data? Let's at least do the math on that. And would you like me to show you the math on that?
Yeah, please show me the math on that, because all right, man. Right on. Conversation on that. And I was like, man, I didn't know if I was going to have to talk to you after this or not, because that's in my notes, man. I said, look, if he doesn't talk about it, I'm definitely going to talk about it with myself. So,
right on, man. Okay, good. Let's see what I can do here. So I'm going to try to pull this up so we can only see some of it at a time. So give me just a second so I can lay this out. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll show you the whole thing at once. How about that?
Okay.
All right. So what we're doing here next is, let's see, share. Mm-hmm. Okay, what we're looking at here is somebody who's got the question, hey, Mark, should I pay my taxes now and have mm-hmm. a tax-free harvest, or should I defer my taxes today and let my money grow at a larger amount, compound at a larger amount? See, the thing is, the promise with the 401k is that, hey, I can defer my tax, and that means I have a bigger nest egg to compound for me,
mm-hmm.
right? But if I pay into a Roth IRA or some sort of after-tax vehicle, I'll have to pay my taxes and I'll have a smaller number to compound for my retirement. So you see mm-hmm. the quandary. A lot of people come to me with this information. We have to take the assumption that the 401k is always good and it came down from Moses' mountain and, you know, it's always the right thing to do for everybody. Let's at least do the math on that. So here's somebody who has $100,000 to invest.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say they've got a 25% tax rate that they're in. Mm-hmm. Let's say our hypothetical growth rate is 6%. It really doesn't matter. We can change these numbers. Do you want to change any of the numbers, or is this okay?
No. Let's rock with that first, and then let's maybe change it after.
All right, cool. So the first thing we're going to do is put money into a tax-deferred vehicle. All right, so let me zoom mm-hmm. in so we can look at this. There we go. Can you see that all right?
Yeah.
$100,000 goes in. We pay no taxes on that money. Mm-hmm. So we have $106,000 at the end of the year because of our 6% return. So far, so good.
Yep.
So we get to reinvest that money and it grows at 6%. We're living in a fantasy world where we're going to get 6% every year, even though I just kind of destroyed that myth, right?
Mm-hmm. But
let's just live in that world for a minute. And for 29 years, I guess.
But then just thinking about it. I mean, you just showed the data behind the way that the market kind of goes up and down and all that stuff, and it tremendously at some point it could hit you. I mean,
yeah,
you know, at any moment, right?
That's right. So it could be right here, right? It could be right there, right before we retire, that the market takes a nosedive.
Yeah. Oh my goodness! Knock on wood, everybody. Knock on wood. Right.
There's a whole thing you and I could talk about if we had the time for it. We probably don't. Called Sequence of Returns Risk. And everyone should go check that out. Sequence of Returns Risk. Plenty of really interesting data on that too. But at the end of the day, this person has to take his money out of his 401k. So he's built his nest egg up from 100 grand to 429,000 bucks. Oh, wait, he has to pay his taxes on that money. So he's after taxes, 25% taxes, right? He deferred it back in the day in his 401k. So now it's owed to the government. And he's now left with $321,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's do the same calculation again, but now let's go ahead and pay our taxes up front. So we only have 75 grand to work with.
Right.
So instead of having 100 grand and then 6,000 of interest, we can only earn 6% on our remaining 75 grand. Bobby, is that making sense so far?
Yeah. It makes sense to me.
So he's got a smaller nest egg and he's got a smaller, he's got a smaller portfolio for 25 years here until he gets down here.
Take it all up front.
Say again.
And then he wants to say, this person, he or she wants to say, take the taxes up front.
That's right.
And then at the end, I just grab all the money to myself without it being taxed.
No taxes due in this scenario. Right. This might be a life insurance policy with cash value that's tax-free. It might be a Roth IRA. But however it happens, at the end of 25 years, I guess the bottom line is we have the exact same amount whether we put it into a tax deferred vehicle or a tax free vehicle, the results are the same. There's literally no mathematical difference between compounding your money in a tax deferred vehicle like a 401k or a tax free vehicle like life insurance or Roth IRAs. The only difference is, and this is really the key difference, is where do you think taxes are going to go over your lifetime?
So that is a great point that you're making. Basically, you're saying at throughout the time that you are living, that you're here on this earth, and that you are going through this process, right? Pre or post tax, depending on which one you decide. The whole tax deferred scenario. You really have to base it off of your years that you're living on this earth, almost, right?
Let's say that we pick poorly and tax rates double over our 25 years, you know, then it would have been way better for us to pay our taxes way up here in year one and have a tax-free future.
So it depends. It all depends.
And what do you think, Bobby? I mean, over your life, you and I are about the same age. Over your lifetime, do you think taxes are going to be a lot lower in the future, or are they going to go up quite a bit?
I don't know. It's so chaotic that I think that I wouldn't want to take that risk. I think I would hire, I'll tell you what I would do. I would hire a financial a planner for me, you know. But if I were to, if I were to really think about it, maybe it's, I'm thinking that it's going to, you're saying which route would I take?
Well, we're back to predicting the future, which is something I try to stay away from, right? But as I look at the national debt that we're in, and I look at the spending plans, and I look at the, you know, I don't care what politics, I leave all that out of it. But I think about it from just a long lifetime standpoint. Over the next 40 or 50 years, with the spending plans, the government programs, and the deficits that we're in today, and the impending baby boomer retirement that's going to suck all that money out of the stock market over the next 20 years, I can't see taxes going down. In fact, we're in one of the lowest tax brackets in recorded history in this country.
So you can only see it going up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And as far as data goes, they only have to go up 1% for it to mathematically make more sense to pay your taxes on the seed today. But most Americans, $30 trillion is wrapped up in tax deferred retirement accounts. Bobby, what does defer mean? What does that word mean? It means push off into the future. We pushed our problems into the future. To the tune of $30 trillion. And now when that time comes, it's going to have bills high. Yeah, man. Not only do we have market volatility bouncing us up and down, but we got a Congress that can vote on how much of your 401k they own every year, which is literally what happens when they vote on your tax bill. So anyway, I know I'm rambling and we got to wrap up. But
good, you know, and so to put it into real life scenarios and terms, right? Are we talking about that Roth IRA versus just your 401k? Are we talking about can you put it into the real terms of how somebody that is not really getting into finance, right? You know, and they're like, look, I just want to throw it out to the financial planner, you know, is choosing, you know, when they say tax deferred versus not, a lot of times it still becomes this. I mean, I look at my parents, they're like, look, I don't educate me, you know. But what would you say, you know, if we're choosing between two different, you know, paths, right, you know, for your future, what are the two different ones we're deciding on?
Yeah, well, you know, there are a number of things, and I know I've taken us too long already.
No, fine. This is great.
Yeah. Well, I can give you a little note that there are a number of different places you can park money, and yes, the Roth IRA is a tax-free vehicle, but it's still tied to the market. We specialize in a tool that uses the bank on yourself concept, which uses cash value life insurance that helps us begin to build money in predictable ways that grows in a straight line, no volatility, and is tax-free in retirement. So that that tool of it's called Bank on Yourself.
Thank you for listening to the Data is My Science podcast, the show that makes data your passion, with your host, Dapper Data.